Across Divides is a podcast that discusses challenges faced by communities around the island of Ireland. In this season, we speak with young people about what peace means to them over a quarter of a century since the signing of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. We discuss the challenges faced by present-day youth and the ways they're making their voices heard. This episode of Across Divides is about understanding one another. It's fairly broad, but understanding is central to peace building and also to youth work. We're going to be looking at identity and inclusion, empathy and respect. The episode contains specific accounts of physical and sexual abuse, and there will be advice at the end and in the episode notes if you feel that any of the issues affect you. I'm speaking today with Auxilia Abafune and Noah Shively-Blinn. I'm going to ask each of our guests to introduce themselves, and this is going to be quite a big discussion with a lot of scope. For the sake of setting the scene of the conversation, I'll start by introducing myself. I was born in Derry in 1995, shortly before the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, and I grew up in County Donegal with a mother from Germany and a father from Northern Ireland. I have a bit of a cross-border upbringing that extends beyond the island even, and I've travelled widely through my work. I think this gives me quite a broad perspective on people's experiences of the world, but I continue to learn a lot from interacting with others. I'm especially looking forward to this conversation and learning from both Noah and Auxilia.
I'm Auxilia. I'm 21 years old. I am a dual citizen of Ireland and Nigeria. I guess like coming here today, like really, it kind of relates a bit to my past because a lot of people don't know this, but like Nigeria also has its own like history of like genocide and stuff like a post-colonization. I'm Igbo specifically, who and our tribe have faced genocide in the 1960s, and they're still like trying to like secede and create their own country out of all of that. So I come from national instability because it's in the West, because it's in Europe. Ireland kind of has this view, like this reputation of being like idyllic, but it's not. And then when you actually come here and I see that actually, no, they also have their own national divides. They also have their own border issues. They also have their own deep-seated conflicts with thousands of years of history. It makes me want to actually understand that more, especially because I live here in the Republic. And in the Republic, I think we don't know as much as probably Northern Irish youth, complexities of all the troubles and how different things overlap with each other and how things have moved on post the Good Friday Agreement.
Thank you, Auxilia. Noah.
I guess I'm here today because I have a different experience. I'm also a dual citizen. So I was born in the United States, but moved here in 2001, lived here for almost 24 years. And so it's all I know, but it was still growing up in like an American household was very interesting in terms of the cultural differences that I would have experienced when I was younger. Wasn't always the best at navigating. It's always been an interesting thing to look at the conflicts here from that kind of a perspective. My parents had no opinion. Like they came here in post just after the troubles finished, and as Americans, like they didn't come here with one side or the other on their mind. So yeah, that's my experience and why I'm here today.
Thank you, Noah and Auxilia. I wonder if we could go into a little bit more detail, considering that you both have backgrounds that extend beyond the island. Could we look a bit more into how that affects your experience of living on an island that is divided into two jurisdictions and how that perhaps compares to the experiences of your peers?
I've been consistently in Ireland for 7 years, but like before that, or 7 or 8 years, but before that I was like in and out, in and out. So I was kind of in two worlds for most of my life. I'd say I definitely relate to the idea of not really fitting in with the peers. When I was younger, people would ask, especially when I was in primary school and wasn't very diverse in primary school, people would ask, oh, are you Protestant or Catholic? They're trying to like fit you in. For me, they see that I'm Black, they see that I'm different, but they're trying to like fit me in. So they ask, oh, are you Protestant or Catholic? I'm like, I don't know what that means.
How did you respond to that?
By that time, I'd know they were Christian denominations, so I just said we're Christians. And like people were like, okay, but are you Protestant or Catholic? And I'm like, I don't know. My mom decided to convert to specifically Catholicism. And then she'd like, if people would ask, she said that she's Catholic. But then my dad like didn't involve himself in that at all. I really didn't relate to all of that. I feel like a bit of like an outside observer of like two parties fighting, but like you don't know the context of what's going on. You don't know the history of what's going on. You don't know who oppressed who before, especially as a child. Like you have no idea of being able to comprehend that it goes that deep.
It must be strange and in some ways difficult to exist in an environment where there's such a binary of identities and perhaps where your own identity does not fit into either of the recognized categories.
I think when I started going to like secondary school, there was kind of considered like a third sex, and the third sex was Muslims. They would pretty much treat anyone who wasn't white as they're automatically part of like the Muslim group, because I wasn't Muslim. Like it was a bit complicated, but like I was like Christian or mixed with aspects of Islam, but I wasn't Muslim. And you feel like no one really like accepts the idea of diversity. Even when people were atheists, even when people stopped believing in God, they started like fitting into one of these three groups, and I didn't fit.
One of the things that we've been talking about in this podcast is how identity is perhaps recognized on this island in a more diverse way than it might have been 25 years ago. I wonder if that's something you would agree with, Noah, based on your experience.
I would say, well, first of all, the diversity is increasing. I would say that skin color, queer identities, like people who go out, like that was always like the goth kids. People from Belfast will know that there's like been like that little goth scene that kind of goes around. Like there's new pride events popping up. The Clerken Pride had their first one either last year, or Enniskillen Pride had their first one last year. There's been a lot of events like that, specifically around the queer community. There's a lot of that we still need to do, especially I think currently around trans rights is seeing significant pushback from particularly conservative groups at the minute. But I do think that the past 15 years, there's been a lot of progress made and a lot more diversity. A society that has no diversity becomes homogenous and then it collapses in on itself and never grows.
What we consider to be peace is something that's changed over time. And peace doesn't just exist between two separate groups, as we've discussed. It needs to be fully inclusive. Auxilia, you've taken part in several youth initiatives, including seminars with the National Youth Council of Ireland. Could you share some of the barriers that you've picked up on to peace building in the broadest sense?
Honestly, I think one of the big things is hidden epidemic of violence across the whole island. Speaking to the Republic, I would say there's a massive epidemic of gender-based violence, and there's a massive epidemic of violence through bureaucracy, as in organizations like the HSC using pen and paper to deny healthcare or to drag out supports that people need, and people do end up dying. I know it's a more concentrated issue that the news talks about in England, but people don't really talk about it in Ireland, because there's a lot of casualties from the way the government treats disabled people and sick people. It will come up again and again in youth topics, but people won't say it directly. People won't say, oh, there's gender-based violence in Ireland. People will just come around. From talking to people, you'll feel that every girl has gone through something. From talking to people, you'll see that loads of disabled people have gone through something. It's not peace if there's still violence going on.
I believe that Northern Ireland is the most dangerous place in Europe to be a woman. It's part of the culture, like you were saying. Every woman, every disabled person, like all have stories about...
Especially disabled women, because they're like about... this is a worldwide statistic, but 83% of disabled women are going to be sexually assaulted at some point in their lives.
The statistics are horrendous, and it's one of those things that is intersectional. Like you need to consider... like all of the factors. You can't just have a strategy.
A
single strand that just is like, oh, we need to make this safer for women. It's like, no, you need to consider
disabled
women and disabled women of color. And
yes,
like you need to stack all those issues on top of each other and say that all of this needs to be dealt with mm-hmm. as a whole.
Auxilia, you described some of these things earlier as hidden violence, but when you talk about them, they're often very explicit. People dying, living on the streets, having their rights removed. Why are these things hidden?
It's because like nobody cares. No one else cares. Like the middle class doesn't care. The rich people don't care. If it gets on the news, it's like one story. If they do talk about it, they never like really put a name on it. We use the word femicide. Other people are not calling it femicide. The state violence that's happening, people don't say state violence because no one wants to think of Ireland as a place that does state violence. Because if Ireland does state violence, where do you go? Have you heard of that thing called the narcissist prayer? So it goes like this. They say that, oh, that didn't happen. And if it did, it wasn't that bad. If it was, it's not a big deal. And if it is, it's not my fault, or it's not the government's fault. And if it was, they didn't mean it. And if they did, you deserved it. That's basically how they go. And that's how the public acts to state violence.
You mentioned how the middle class and what I would call the ruling class don't care. But then those people who are in that ruling class turn around to the media and push sort of the far right talking points that then generate hatred between working class people.
Yeah.
Because when it comes down to it, like every refugee and asylum seeker, they're working class.
Exactly.
And like Irish working class people are also, when it comes down to that, it's like everything that the far right says, there's a kernel of truth that it starts as, and then they grow it into this horrific nest of lies. That kernel of truth is that having refugees and asylum seekers coming in, it is objectively causing harm to certain communities, but it's not because those refugees are coming in. It's because the government isn't doing enough to integrate those people. I live in a like working class Protestant area. I'm not a Protestant. I'm an artist, so I'm like on the border between middle and working class. The thing that really kind of gets me going on this topic is the fact that all of these asylum seekers and refugees who come in and who aren't allowed to work, like they're pushed into hotels, they're isolated, they're not represented in your local community. And that goes back to like my area. We had those horrific racist signs go up. I'm white. But if I wasn't white, that would be, and living in that neighborhood, that would have been terrifying.
If they think you're an immigrant, they think you're a refugee, they think you're someone that they are free to hate, they're going to beat on you. And honestly, I know you say like, obviously, because you're white, even in America, like right now, the way they're treating refugees, it doesn't matter if you're white or not.
Oh, yeah.
If you're an immigrant over there, you're cooked, like regardless of what color you are. That's the thing, like far right rhetoric, it's a global movement. Like when people say, oh, the far right in Germany, or the far right in Netherlands, the far right in America, or Ireland, like all of them are connected. All of them are talking to each other.
You're both talking here about disinformation and the far right. I'm just wondering, where is it that you learn about these things? Is it through social media?
I think we probably have the same TikTok feed. So like that is a big source. But it's when it comes to TikTok, obviously you have to be careful with any media you consume, and you have to make sure that the things that are coming out are truthful. I've probably learned more actual factual information from TikTok than the mainstream media over the course of the past 5 years.
I also read a lot of like Wikipedia, and like sometimes if you talk about something on TikTok, it will automatically link a Wikipedia page. So I click those pages and I'm reading, and then I click the other pages and I'm reading. I just found out about like the newer people in South Sudan who are actively being genocided. You know about that as well. I never knew that they were a completely egalitarian culture. Like they didn't have a patriarchy. They've never had a patriarchy. They've never had a monarchy. They've never had like dynasties. They've only ever been democratic, equal people since the inception of their whole ethnicity. I saw this girl on TikTok and we became friends. She was just talking about like how this stuff has happened. Like, and it's kind of exactly what you're saying. TikTok will show you things you never knew.
I don't personally use TikTok. I know it can be a fantastic source of information. I also know that it's a platform on which hate is also spread. So how can you distinguish between information that is true and untrue? And how does that affect the way that young people perceive the issues that are going on in the world around them?
When the far right has a problem with lying, they take, like I was saying earlier, they take a kernel of truth of something that is happening, it's a real thing, and then they warp it, they add a ridiculous amount of spin to turn it into a completely different talking point, which they then run with. And the problem with that is it takes them all of 60 seconds to put that out, and then it will take some content creator like a series of 10 3-minute videos to debunk everything that they said in that 60 seconds, and it's exhausting trying to beat that back with factual information.
The thing is, they will use that kernel of truth as the proof.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll be like, oh, this is the proof for the whole thing. But like, you have to know then the other context. And that takes a lot of research and reading. Yeah. People don't read. Listen, I love TikTok, but people, they don't read. Or they're very young. Mm-hmm. And it causes a lot of problems.
We're going down a really interesting thread here because we're talking about understanding one another, and TikTok and social media is one way through which young people are getting to know other young people and also issues that are faced by other young people within their own countries and also around the world. Auxilia, you've actually used TikTok as a platform to raise your own voice. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah. I was a bit of a TikToker. Then I kind of stopped like late last year because there was, oh my goodness. And I'll tell you why. Because I was talking about like my story as like a trafficking survivor and a sexual assault survivor. There's this guy on TikTok going around and he will comb through sexual assault survivors' TikToks, trying to find their information and report it on their behalf. But the thing is, though, it's putting a lot of people in danger because the whole reason people don't report is that it might be dangerous. I'm a survivor of what's called RAMCOA. So that's RAMCOA. It stands for ritual abuse, torture-based mind control, and organized abuse. So that's basically anything like child torture and child sex trafficking. And obviously, that's a very heavy topic. And that's not something that people really like to talk about. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, that when people say something and makes them feel unstable in their own country or feel like unsafe or feel like they're at risk, they don't want to hear it. So they kind of tell you like, oh, you're lying, or they push it down, or they just like, if you try to share on Instagram, it goes nowhere. Like there's this person who called Ritual Abuse Association. They've been sharing for like 4 years about this kind of thing. And their posts get maybe like 2,000 likes. I'll say like something for like 60 seconds and it gets like 40K likes. I don't really remember how many views. So it would have a big effect. And like you could easily post a lot of information. I made this document called the Alpha to Omega of Torture-Based Mind Control, which is basically like about like 20-something different kinds of like torture-based mind control and how it's done and why it's done. Not necessarily why it's done, because you can tell like they're doing it to exploit kids, but like it helped a lot of people and I could easily advertise it per se on TikTok. Now I don't do it anymore because it's just not safe. Also, another issue is that one of my abusers tried, you know, when you send a message request and then, but if it's maybe by mistake, you can go and delete the message, but the message request is still there. So it's an empty request. He accidentally sent me one of those. So like, I think he accidentally DM'd me on TikTok. So like one of my abusers. So I'm like, yeah, it's just not safe.
Thank you for sharing your story, Auxilia. You said that people would be shocked to hear that this happened in Ireland.
Yeah, that's another thing. When people hear about Nigeria, I'm like, oh, so that happened in Nigeria. I'm like, yeah, it happened in Nigeria. It also happened here. It also happened in the UK. It was a multi-country thing, international thing. And that's not just happening to me. I have another friend who it only happened to in the UK and Ireland. Other people only happen in Ireland. I'm like, it's happening all over the time, especially to foster kids. People don't notice when it's happening to foster kids, especially because if they've been removed from one situation and they go into a different situation and they're being like abused in that situation, people are like more reluctant to take them from that situation because like, well, we've already just moved you. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's happening all the time.
I'm really starting to get an understanding, Auxilia, of what you mean by hidden violence in Ireland. And I suppose for young people, social media is a powerful way of bringing issues to light. You've done so based on your own very personal experience and amongst your peers on TikTok, perhaps to give voice to others in similar situations. Since we're talking on this podcast about youth work and you've been involved with youth projects in Dublin, I wonder whether you feel that there are platforms for you to raise your story in youth forums and whether it's been helpful for you to do so.
I think it's really hard to bring it up with youth, especially the sexual part, because immediately people start wondering about like the safety of the children, especially because a lot of these youth groups allow people as young as 12. I usually, like my account on TikTok was 16 plus. Because I was just like, I just don't feel people younger than that are equipped to understand. Like, even when I was under 16, I couldn't understand what I was going through as I was actively going through it. So I just felt kids that young couldn't really talk about it in front of them. And then obviously, because it's not a space that I curated, it's a space somebody else curated. I feel like people should be able to consent to hearing about that. Even though, like, obviously I didn't consent to go through it. It's just, I don't think it's fair because there are reports of people getting secondhand PTSD from hearing things too deeply because I don't create those spaces because I didn't curate the space. I don't talk about it there.
So who needs to hear your story in order to protect others?
Social workers,
yeah.
And teachers and principals, like school-based kind of thing. People who work with children. Telltale signs, not always all the same. And it's kind of a skill that needs to be learned. What we also need is like people who can invest into specific facilities for survivors of trafficking and torture, because I have found that the facilities that exist right now are very much not sufficient. I went to Ruhama, which is supposed to be for survivors of trafficking, and they said they couldn't help me because it was too complex. Most of the women who went there were survivors of adult trafficking. I felt like they just didn't understand me at all. Like, even though they knew the terms of what I was going through and they knew it by the book, I felt like they didn't have experience to actually help. So, yeah.
You said, Auxilia, that what you were facing was too complex to be helped. If we come back to where we started this conversation, the issues that young people face are complex and interconnected, and the services and forums for young people need to be responsive to that.
I think people see youth as inherently a non-complex group, because all the older people are like, oh, I was young once and now I have much more stress because I have a family and stuff like that. But like the youth, the way to be a youth now is not the same as the way to be a youth back then. So I think people try to, that's a really important thing. Like being a youth in this world, in this economy, is complex by default.
Auxilia, thank you for sharing your story with us. I hope doing so within this context has been helpful in order to raise issues of hidden violence that people might not be aware of on this island. Your reflections on the complexity of issues affecting young people have really brought to light the shortcomings of youth services and the need for them to be able to respond to the interconnectedness of challenges facing young people. Noah, perhaps we could come on to your experience of being a young person in Northern Ireland and how you would reflect on that complexity, whether you feel that the forums and services offered to youth are able to respond.
So I am diagnosed with autism and non-binary. I just don't really care about gender identity. Like I'll present the way I want. But when it comes down to it, like I had to go private to get my autism diagnosis because it was missed in school. And so I had no chance of getting into like the child services, like the child mental health services to get that diagnosis younger. I applied for, like tried to go through my GP to get onto the NHS waiting list, which would be 2 years, but I could wait 2 years. So I did that. And then 6 months later, I got a phone call from the adult mental health services saying I'd been referred for 6 sessions of like anxiety counseling. And that was it. Like that was what they'd put me through for. And it's like, that's just not what I asked for. For me, I was extremely lucky. My parents, they handed me the money for it. Basically, they helped me go private, was able to get it sorted. I was incredibly privileged and lucky to have that support. Because I know that for a lot of people, they won't have that support. It's not necessarily violence, but it's something that is direct discrimination in that sense of like, I went to a medical professional and said, look, I need this help. It speaks to like a level of ableism.
One thing you were saying earlier, when you were growing up, it was missed. But then when you become someone who's going into the work field, it's hitting you heavily. That's another thing that makes me feel like being a youth is inherently complex, because that's a problem for a lot of autistic people, that the skills that they need as a young person, as a younger student, they can manage on their own, or they can manage mostly on their own. But the skills of the world that you need as a full grown adult is far too much for them. But people see that, oh, you didn't struggle that much as a child, so all these other things should be fine. And I'm like, those are not the same thing. Those are not the same level of responsibility. And it also makes me feel like there should be a radical change on the perspective youth is seen. Like from like 16 to 26, I don't think you're a child. I don't think you're an adult. I think you're someone who needs to have like the legal privilege to do what you want as an adult, but have the social protection, not that a child would, but kind of like what a child would. Like there should be a youth protective services. There should be
like a new distinction of young person that's actually like a defined protected
exactly class. Protected class. And that they should have certain rights from the government, like extra rights for their protection.
Well, one thing I was going to say, the thing you were talking about, like being fine in school, and then the signs were all there. That's why I say it was missed, because all my teachers, every parent teacher meeting, were like, you're one of the most enthusiastic, interested people. You can answer every question in class. You're clearly listening. But anytime there was an exam, that's when the cracks showed.
As a young adult, what did receiving your diagnosis mean for you?
I got my diagnosis. I was in my second or third year of working at Lloyds Bank in their call center, it really helped because I was able to, I was starting to burn out, but I had got myself into a really good position. I was working for the personal banking fraud team. So every single call was different. Every single call was interesting. Every single call was helping people. It was really engaging. And I never felt like I'd hit the peak of what I was doing because I knew I could always do that a little bit better. And it was probably the best environment that I'd worked in. But getting that diagnosis meant that when I did have a period of burnout just from being exhausted, it wasn't the job. It was more just I'd been working for so long. I worked all the way through COVID in the office and everything. So I'd hit the point where I was burned out and I needed 2 weeks just a sick leave. But my diagnosis meant that I was able to turn around and they were actually helpful. They were really understanding of that. It really helped.
Is there a sense of empowerment that comes from having that kind of understanding of what is going on, what's happening to you? Does that give voice for either of you?
Yeah, I absolutely helped. I remember the first time I found the acronym RAMCOR, I was still in the situation while I was going, and finding that word made me realize how wrong it was. At the time, I was just thinking I'll just have to deal with this, going through this while going to university or going, I was in leaving cert. I just finished my exams and I found a community of other survivors. All these people, except one of them, had left their situation when I discussed this, and they could tell me how wrong these things were. So that's later that very year, they helped me. And it was later that very year, I packed my stuff and I went to a domestic violence shelter. And then that was the end of that. I've never seen my abusers again in real life anyways. I actually have this crazy story. This other girl who was being trafficked by the same group, because it's a multinational group, she was being trafficked in the UK. Because I was posting about it. We had known each other in real life, but lost contact because our abusers took us to different places. She found me again on TikTok and we started talking, we started discussing, we kind of verified who each other were. Because of that word, because of that very phrase, she was able, she was in a wheelchair at the time because she had cerebral palsy and she would not be able to take a flight on her own. So I went over to the UK and brought her back here. And now she's in Winston's protection, being taken care of. And it was just one word. Because if that phrase didn't exist, if someone didn't come up with the term RAMCOA, we wouldn't have found each other. And I really also, on the side of having a phrase for your disabilities, so autism, and also diagnosed with autism. And when I did get my diagnosis, which was a late diagnosis because of, I was very much special needs in school and I was in special needs program, but my abusers never took me to get the care that I needed. So I didn't get diagnosed until I was an adult. So having that has allowed me to access, explain my needs better in more proper terms that other people understand. And I can advocate for my needs better because I have the language to do so.
One of the things that I think is actually quite toxic that I've heard is, or parents specifically saying they don't want to seek a diagnosis for their kids because they don't want them to be labeled. And that is one of the worst things you can do to your kid, because it's just, yes, the label is going to have an impact. And I'm not going to sit here and deny that. It will have an impact, but it's more important with the society we have to have that label so that you can properly advocate for your rights. Because if you don't have that label, I was entitled to extra time all the way through school. And that probably wouldn't have saved my A-levels, but it would have saved I would have done better in GCSEs. Any parents listening to this, if you've had that thought, don't beat yourself up, because it's a product of the inherently ableist society we live in, that you don't want your kid to be labeled with a disability. But not giving them the label is even more toxic, because it means that we can't advocate for what we need.
Because I feel like sometimes when they say they don't want to give their kids a label, they're worried more about what their family might think, or they might worry about what the neighbors might think of the fact that they have a disabled kid, rather than what's actually going to happen in that kid's future. Because if you label them and they can get reasonable accommodations because of that label, they're going to do better in education and employment, which are the things that actually matter and the things that actually are the symbol of how well your kid is doing. Because at the end of the day, the label is not what gives your kid disability. The disability is there whether or not we have the word for it or not. So when we have the word for it, that's when is actually taken care of and they can have a better life.
And considering other people's reality and having a way of recognizing it is a form of empathy, and being able to actually foster that, it's a form of recognizing and legitimizing other people's lived experiences and defining them in a way that develops understanding across diverse backgrounds and lived experiences, so that there can be compassion and ultimately forms of peace within and between people on the island. Because ultimately that's what peace is. It's living with mutual understanding and compassion and empathy between people who are different from one another. So far in this episode, we've been talking about understanding, empathy, labeling, service provision. You've raised a question around supporting young people through the transitionary period from adolescence to adulthood, creating that as an age group set apart in response to the complexity of a period of life when people need a balance of autonomy and support. We've discussed a few thoughts and ideas around that about complexity and intersectionality, and perhaps that's something we could dive into a bit deeper, because you've both said that these things aren't taken into consideration enough. Having covered some of these things in depth already and introduced them, I suppose my question would be, how would you think that having a holistic view of these intersectional issues can actually be transformed into action, and in particular policy that serves the complex needs of young people? Where do we go with this kind of thinking?
I think maybe there needs to start being maybe like try organizations. Say if there's a psychiatric hospital, there needs to be something that's a psychiatric hospital for homeless people and refugees or something like that. Like something that mixes a couple things together. Because I remember what I was saying with the generations thing. Obviously, there are some older people there who had no up or down, similar to no up or down. There are no family to look after them, basically. A lot of those people are homeless. A lot of those people are refugees. And sometimes when you see that they ended up in psychiatric wards, if you talk to them and you learn their story, it's kind of almost like, well, where else would you go? Like, obviously, if someone is without their family, is not being housed, and I'm saying this because I'm in the homeless system myself, if you're in that kind of system where it kind of aggravates on your mental health, of course you're going to go basically insane, because that's not how the human condition is supposed to work, and that's not how we're supposed to live. And that's the thing about intersectionality. And I also wanted to say that intersectionality, it was a word invented in the 1950s, 1960s by like feminists back then, because they said, okay, well, instead of just focusing on women, we also need, this was American feminists, so they also wanted to focus on Black women. And then that also got expanded to gay women, and that also got expanded to disabled women and poor women.
Noah, do you want to pick up on this around oppression and the intersectionality of that oppression? You are involved with the Green Party. Perhaps you can give us a perspective of this from a policy point of view and a governance response.
The question about how we can, at a government level, so you have the Department for Communities who deal with housing, you have the Department for Infrastructure who failed to deal with the infrastructure. Yeah. We have all this stuff. What we almost need is like a Department for Humanity. It would be a department that would sit within government here. You could do the same thing in the South with like a minister, but we'd have the Department for Humanity who would act as a bridge between all of our siloed institutions. Like there is a problem with the way our government works, the way our departments work up here, because when the ministries are divided out through the Hunt formula and everything after an election, they're handed out to the different parties, but all the parties that they often will not communicate with each other because they're from different parties. If we could create a Department for Humanity that would talk about that intersectionality, but just be the bridge between the different departments to...
Maybe like the Department of Humanity should have its own party rather than being like a bunch of different parties.
It could be something that's nonpartisan.
Its own order.
It brings in like a completely new set of people. Could be people who already exist, like the Children's Commissioner or the Disabilities Commissioner, like they could form part of that.
I think there's an inherent difference between departments that are for demographics, like departments of, you said, children and department of disability. Like those things, they should be more on like the humanity side, because like they're demographic of humanity, versus something that's like Department of Infrastructure or Department of Finance. Those are just general logistics.
Wouldn't those departments be bridged by the Department of Humanity? I mean, if you look at the Department for Economy, surely bringing in a greater element of ethics and compassion would be of benefit there. And certainly when I think of the Department of Transport and making transport accessible and also far-reaching both in urban and rural areas, that is something that would come under humanity.
And I'm sure your experiences as a wheelchair user have probably been horrendous. But even personally for me, from my experience of like being left in the middle of nowhere on a freezing cold bus stop for 2 hours because the bus just hasn't showed up, things like that, personally for me, have been like, that is part of humanity, is because there's people like, I'm young, fit, healthy, I can withstand standing in the freezing cold for that long. Mm-hmm. But there's... like, especially in my area, there's elderly people who live around me who that's incredibly unhealthy for them to stand waiting for a bus, never shows up because TransLink, I just had it not to show up.
I had to call fire services. Like, I had to call emergency services because of a similar situation. It was like really cold, like, you know, the cold blocks, the cold quick that we had like late last year, and a bus ghosted for like 45 minutes. Not only that, but also the cold takes battery out of your wheelchair. I'm like, if my battery goes dead, I'm cooked. So I had to call like fire services to like get help and also transport between these two places, because I know it was complicated for y'all to be able to get transport for me to here.
Can I just check, how did you get here today?
I got the train and I couldn't get the earlier train because they didn't have space for a wheelchair user on board. I'm like, bro, you're a train, bro. You literally carry like freight. They didn't have space for a wheelchair user on board, so I had to get the 11:50 train. So I got here exactly at 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. And then panicked for a little bit, but we got here. So we're alive. And also once an hour, like, come on.
The Department of Humanity sounds like the kind of risk and experiment that you were describing earlier, Auxilia, with having trilateral services. I can totally imagine the fear response that such a proposal could elicit. Also, every time that we talk about policy change in response to any of the issues that we've talked about in this podcast, people have brought really tangible responses. And this is one of them. But they've also mentioned the importance of kindness, empathy, and compassion in delivering these sorts of services. And I think that you've bridged, in a way, with something that even, you know, I'm listening to Department of Humanity, and we've all laughed a little bit at it. But at the same time, it is finding a tangible policy response to things that people mention again and again and again as being lacking in delivering services that meet the needs of people whose issues are complex and have multiple layers to them and don't stand alone and are intersectional and are just human.
Do you know, I think honestly, government officials need to hear this, even clips of what we're saying, because they need to get it in their heads that they need to take a radical approach to fixing things. Because the neoliberal capitalist approach is just like, do the same thing again, have boom or bust cycles, recession and growth. Like, we don't need that. Obviously I'm a socialist, so obviously I want a full transfer to socialism, but like, even without a full transfer to socialism, we don't need suffering like this if you just take a more vigorous approach to things and a little bit more chance. Because like, what's the worst thing that could happen if a Department of Humanity happens? Nobody signs up to work. Oh well, at least we tried.
You're saying that you want politicians to hear this. Do you feel that you have platforms and forums to present these ideas and really have them heard?
I'm not even joking when I says I'm going after this probably straight into the channels I have within the Green Party to start working on an actual proposal for like the Department for Humanity to see if it's feasible, because
I want to copy out the notes too and say something as well.
This would be something that we could actually push as a party, because it's what the Greens in the North are incredibly socially aware and are always looking for things like that. But I never, until this conversation, I never even thought about what if we could have a body that like works between all the organizations and makes things more efficient. So I'm definitely going to
take... Department for Government Efficiency, but it's actually good.
Yeah,
it's not run by Elon Musk.
Thank you to Auxilia and Noah for such a deep and lively discussion. The Department of Humanity is an example of the curiosity and creativity that young people bring to the table when it comes to addressing issues that directly affect them across the island. It's also a reflection on understanding through kindness and compassion, seeking to know a variety of perspectives and experiences which form the basis of peace building. Thank you for listening to this episode of Across Divides. If you feel that you need support with any of the issues raised in this podcast, you can find a list of organizations and contact details in the episode notes. Thank you for listening to Across Divides. If you would like to learn more about the project, go to icommunityhub.org. iCommunity is a collaborative all-island project run by the WEAL and the Northern Ireland Council for Voluntary Action. It is supported by the Department of Foreign Affairs Shared Island Civic Society Fund and the Shared Island Unit in the Department of the Taoiseach. This series was created thanks to the collaborative efforts of the National Youth Council of Ireland and Youth Action Northern Ireland. Thanks also to the Shared Island Youth Forum and to all of the guests who took part in the podcast.